So for those of you that don't know, I work for Bruce installing dog fences. And after I install the fence, I teach the person how to train the dog to use the fence, really, because contrary to what some people believe, it's not a magic fence. Like, you don't just put it in and all of a sudden the dog stays in the yard. It's a training device. And people need to be trained how to train the dog for it. And I've taught it hundreds of times by now. And at this point, I know based on how the person is looking at me, the look in their face, their expression as they're looking at the dog, I know exactly what questions are going through their mind. And I know at certain points in my spiel exactly what questions are going to come up. And I've actually adapted my spiel over the times to just answer those questions automatically. Like, I'll say something and then I'll immediately say, like, oh, but you also got to keep in mind this. And that's why I've adapted. And then I've learned to recognize the questions that people ask and the assumptions that people bring into their understanding. But even then, sometimes I'm blindsided by just like crazy off the wall questions that you can tell they have no idea how this thing actually works, which is fine because for a lot of them, it's brand new equipment. They've never seen anything like this before. So it's understandable. And I say that to say that in this text today, what we're going to see is Paul, just like a good teacher, just like someone who's taught something repetitively again and again and again, he knows when questions are going to come up. He knows when wrong assumptions are going to come up. So like sometimes when I'm describing how a fence works or when they're asking me to install it certain ways, I have to remind them that like, no, the wire has to get all the way back to the garage and make a circle. I can't turn off spots like... And I just have to explain certain things because there are assumptions people bring into it. And that's exactly what Paul's doing in the text here. He knows what he has been saying can be taken in a wrong way. And he knows that the people he's speaking to have certain assumptions that are probably kind of shading how they're hearing what he's been saying. So what we're going to see in this first part of chapter 3 is him just automatically addressing those questions and addressing those assumptions. Because by this point, he's probably been teaching the gospel for about 20 years or so. So he knows the objections that people are going to bring up. And we're going to see that throughout this text and really throughout the book. Paul's a really good teacher. He's really good at knowing what his readers, what his listeners are going to be thinking. And he just automatically answers them for them. So this first part of chapter 3 is... thankfully, probably for a lot of you, the last part of the first part of Romans, the guilty section. And I'm going to talk through later why Paul has been taking so much time. But suffice it to say, this is the last one. So you guys can just sit through this one and then we can start getting to the good news. So I know that's where we all want to be. We also want to skip Romans 1:18 through 3:20 and just get like right to 3:21. But we do need to actually finish this section first. So I am going to talk about 3:1 through 20 and... next week, Caleb will pick up in 21 with the good news. So I'm going to get like right to the hinge, right to the end of the bad news as he preps his way into the good news, and then we're going to stop. So I know it's on purpose. I'm sorry if it's like a cliffhanger, but... and then where we've been to this point and what Paul's been doing up till now. In the first part, so the end of chapter 1, he condemned the pagans or the secularists and showed how those who have natural revelation, those who have the natural law, know something about God, and they've still chosen to reject it. And then in the first part of chapter 2, he accused the prosecutor or the moralist, those that think that they can do enough good to not be guilty, those that think they can just do the right thing. Well, I'm better than so-and-so. Well, Paul says, maybe, but that's not going to help you. Because you still stand condemned and your verdict is still guilty. And then we saw at the end of chapter 2 that he spoke as well to the professional or the legalist and said, okay, you know the law, you're trying to do the law, great. But if that's what you're relying in, you're still guilty. So up until this point, he's been accusing people and showing them justly condemned. And he has done this for, like I said, the pagan, the prosecutor, and the professional. Now, however, just as a good teacher, he's going to let the automatic assumptions and the questions of what he knows is an entitlement mentality, he's going to let them accuse him with the automatic arguments that he knows are coming up, they're like, okay, well, this isn't actually just. So now we don't have Paul accusing somebody. Now we have the entitled crowd accusing Paul. And when I say the word entitled, with our day and age, I think the word millennial just kind of comes to our mind. And that's not actually a bad analogy, and I'm going to explain it more later as we go. But I mean, like, think of the culture we've kind of created today. You have the participation trophies. You have people showing up to work. Well, I showed up, so I should get $20 an hour, right? And you have all these types of things happening. And sometimes I almost feel bad being part of my generation because I am a millennial and I see all these things happening. I'm like, why? Like, that doesn't even make sense. But entitlement is something that we're familiar with, something that we know in our culture and that we can understand pretty well. And we're going to see how it didn't start recently. Entitlement's been around for a long time. And we're going to see how that entitlement thinking was influencing the Jews at Paul's time and how he's actually counteracting their arguments that they're going to be bringing up. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at their objections. We're going to see what type of case these entitled Jews are making. So we're going to start in chapter 3, verse 1. It says, "Then what advantage has the Jew, or what is the value of circumcision?" So the first objection they're bringing is, okay, well, then there's no advantage to being a Jew. I mean, look back at what he just said in chapter 2. He said, okay, you have the law, you have circumcision, but a real Jew is one who is circumcised in the heart. So they're looking at what he's just been saying in chapter 2 and how he's found even the Jews condemned, and they're like, well, then what good is it being a Jew? Like, why does this even matter? And his answer to that is, well, you have the word of God. He says in verse 2, "Much in every way. To begin with, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God." Now, it's ironic, he says to begin with, or depending on translation, you have first or primarily or chiefly. So it's kind of awkward what to use there, because the word is actually like a first in a sequence, but he never actually gets to number 2 because he kind of distracts himself with his argument, which happens kind of occasionally throughout the book of Romans. It's because Paul's just like got a lot of stuff going through his mind. He's got this case he wants to make, and he starts doing a sequence, and he's like, well, actually, this is really important, so I'm going to start talking about this for a while. And you see that kind of going on here. Yeah, he says, well, they're objecting that, like, okay, well, then being a Jew doesn't actually matter. Like, why did God have the whole history of choosing the Jews and everything if none of this actually matters? He says, well, you actually do have a huge advantage in that you were given the laws of God. You were the guardians of the redemptive plan for man that God gave to you to keep. And ironically, they had a tremendous advantage because they had the word from which they should have known everything that had been said up to this point. Paul's not really saying new stuff to them. If you look through the Old Testament and how God has been giving the law and what type of life God calls, you see that he's ultimately honoring faith more than just legalistic obedience. And he doesn't honor just trying to be better than so-and-so. And he obviously doesn't honor the pagan with, I do what I want and I just don't care about what I have that's been revealed to me about God. So he kind of flips the tables on them. He's like, well, you're saying you have no advantage, but you kind of already knew all of this. So you have a huge advantage. So he says that as kind of like a balance. Okay, chapter 2, he's like, okay, well, you have no advantage in the judgment. But 3, he's like, well, you do have an advantage because you knew the judgment was coming. So don't say you don't have an advantage. And then the next objection they bring up, we're going to see in verse 3. And it's, well, what if some were unfaithful? Does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? And this one, at first, we look at it and it's like, well, what objection is actually being made here? Because does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? It's like, okay, well, if they're disobedient, does that make God no longer care about them? Like, it's kind of what we'd think the objection is. But actually, what they're getting at is that what they're saying is, okay, if God is condemning us for our unfaithfulness, then God isn't faithful, because a faithful God doesn't condemn the Jews. And this is where you really see that entitlement thinking coming through. Because what's happening here is Paul is grappling with a understanding of the faithfulness and the righteousness of God that only ends in good things for the Jews. Because God's faithfulness to us means that God is good to us and that God blesses us. Which, again, he told them, you have the word of God. And if you look at the entire Old Testament, especially Deuteronomy 28, you see very plainly and in a very large section that God is faithful both when he blesses and also definitely when he punishes them for disobedience. It says directly in Deuteronomy 28, like, if you don't follow these things, this is going to happen to you. So he's grappling with this false view that God is only faithful to me when he is good to me. And he's saying, no, look back at this word that you have. How can you say that God's faithfulness is only good things? And I think it's significant here, especially the quote that he uses. In verse 4, he says, by no means, let God be true, though everyone is a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. Flip back to Psalm chapter 51 real quick. So Psalm chapter 51, which is a fairly familiar psalm, and it's definitely on purpose by Paul. So this psalm was written by David after he had been kind of condemned for his sin against Bathsheba. Nathanael had revealed to him and helped him to see the error in his ways. And then you read in verse 4, against you and you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you may be justified in your words and blameless in your judgment. And then turn back to Romans. It says, by no means let God be true, though everyone is a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. So the Israelites here are operating on this assumption that God's faithfulness, that his justness, that his righteousness is centered on his blessing to them. And Paul points them back to this important psalm of King David, who is a man after God's own heart, saying that God is just to condemn him for his sin, and that God is faithful to himself to condemn David for this sin. So he's showing the Jews that the very word that they have shows that God's faithfulness is much broader than the view that they're assuming. God's faithfulness is not just blessing. It is just as much seen in his correction and in his discipline and in his punishment. So the first objection that he had to deal with was that there's just no advantage to being a Jew, which he directly contradicts that and says, well, no, you knew this was coming. And then his second objection that he's dealing with was a wrong view of the faithfulness of God. And now there we see the answer. And in the third objection, we see that he's going to deal with kind of the going further into the justice of how this condemnation is working. So we look at verse 5. But if our unrighteousness serves to show the righteousness of God, what shall we say? That God is unrighteous to inflict wrath on us? I speak in a human way. By no means, for then how could God judge the world? But if through my lie God's truth abounds to his glory, why am I still being condemned as a sinner? And why not do evil that good may come? As some people slanderously charge us with saying, their condemnation is just. So basically what his accusers are saying is, okay, so if our unfaithfulness brought the punishment of God, and then if our unrighteousness brought about this righteousness of God, and our rebellion led eventually to Christ coming and dying and bringing salvation, so then why are we being punished for something that helped to fulfill the plan of God? So what they're getting is, okay, how can he be just for punishing us for something that he used for good? Like, didn't we just help him? So where is the justice in this? That's the complaint that they're bringing. And I think accurately what Paul does here is he kind of just points out the logic of what they're saying. He says in verse 6, "By no means, for then how could God judge the world? But if through my lie God's truth abounds to his glory, why am I still being condemned? And why not do evil that good may come? As some people slanderously charge us with saying." So he's basically saying that if people's unrighteousness cannot be condemned because God can use it for righteousness, then there is no unrighteousness that can be condemned. Because God is sovereign and powerful enough to use any sin, use any unrighteousness for his purposes. So the God who can do that, if he isn't able to condemn and to justly punish those who committed that unrighteousness, then there's nobody that he can actually condemn. And he's also saying, okay, just take your logic a step further. If you're saying, well, how can our unrighteousness be condemned because it led to Christ coming and it led to salvation? If you use that line of argument with really any sin, then you can say, well, how can God condemn this sin? Because God can use this sin for good. So the logic that you've just opened the door for would allow for any sin. Your logic would allow for unbounded, unpunishable sin. And again, I think it's very appropriate and accurate here. He doesn't really spend time going into like the theological problems with your assumption and everything. He's like, just look at your logic. Like, that doesn't even make sense. So we've seen that Paul is addressing this wrong view of faithfulness that the people are assuming. And it's not to say that every Jew had this assumption, but he knows that there are some people reading his letter who are going to be thinking this. And what they're thinking is, okay, well, we're Jews. We have this covenant with God. And this covenant means that God's going to be good to us. So all I need to do is be a Jew, and then God's going to be good to me. And again, it's not that every Jew was thinking that. There's a spectrum, just like in everything else. Some Jews thought that, okay, well, I'm in this covenant, and then as long as I am staying obedient, then I'm keeping myself in the covenant, and then God will be good to me. Some Jews thought that, well, I'm just born in the covenant, so therefore I'm good. Other Jews thought that, well, you have to work, and you have to kind of keep earning your salvation. We see that kind of almost in the Pharisaical viewpoint, where they're so works-focused. But again, there's a variety in their viewpoints. But what Paul's addressing here is one of the arguments that he knows is going to come up, which is the wrong view of what God's faithfulness looks like. And also really a wrong view of just God's justice. Because what they're doing is they're looking at God's justice and they're trying to put a human perspective on it and make it fair with a human perspective. And how common is that in our own viewpoint? How often do we look at the teachings of the Bible? Do we look at our life? Do we look at really God's wrath in general and say, well, that's not fair? Like, how could a good God send people to hell? How often do we take our own view of fairness and allow it to shape Scripture rather than allowing Scripture to shape our view of what fairness is as it relates to God's justice? So I don't think this is that crazy of an argument here. Sometimes we look at this argument and we're like, well, like, how are these objections even brought up? But how many times do we bring these same objections in our mind? How many times do we justify what we want to do because, well, it's going to lead to good ends? Or like, God can use it. I know it's not like the best motivation. I know this isn't the best way to do this, but it's definitely going to have a better end for me than doing the right thing. Or it's going to be easier for me than doing the right thing. Like, how many times do we use the ends justifies the means type thinking in our own life? So I think that's what he's battling here. And then it's ironic at the end, he says, their condemnation is just. So the very people who say this, some of which might be Jews, the very people who say that God isn't just to condemn, he's saying their condemnation is just. And then we have a fourth and a final objection, which is raised up, which is, so Jews then are really no better off than the Gentiles when it comes to judgment. Exactly. That's the point. That's what Paul's been getting at to this point, what he wanted them to see. He needed to break down this, well, I can just do enough things to earn my salvation. Or he needed to break down this, well, I am a Jew, so obviously God is going to be faithful to me, and obviously I won't be condemned because God won't forsake his people, which, again, ignores all of the promises in the Old Testament that God will punish his people who forsake him. So we finally get to this proper objection, and Paul totally agrees with this. He says, what then? Are we Jews any better off? No, not at all. For we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. I just want to stop a moment here. I think it's important how he phrases that. It says, for we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, so all people, you guys who think you're righteous, you guys who think you're a part of the covenant, you're just as bad off as the people who have never heard any of the words of God. And he also says that all are under sin. It's not that, well, you know, you've sinned once in a while, you've committed sins, or you've been kind of sinful, or you've done these things. No, you're under sin. It's like, it is your Lord right now. You have chosen to make sin your Lord, and you're under its dominion. And then I love the string of psalms that he puts together here, and most of them are psalms. There's one from Isaiah, but you can almost see him just using these words perfectly here to just combat the automatic arguments that come up. He says, okay, none are better off. Both Jews and Greeks, all are under sin. You can just hear the but in their minds, and he's like, none is righteous. No, not one. And like, you just hear as he's quoting this, okay, none is righteous. But what about me? No. What about not one? And you see him purposely arranging these here just to totally obliterate any argument that anybody can have that there is anything that they can do on their own to not face God's condemnation. None is righteous. No, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together, they have become worthless. What's funny about this is, okay, if you've taken a literature class, what do they always tell you about universal statements? Don't use them. Be super careful and be able to substantiate your use of that universal statement, because universal statements are, I'm going to not use universal statement, universal statements are usually wrong. And what is the whole first part of this string of quotes here? Universal statements. And that's the point. He's been just drilling it in these first three chapters that all universal, every single person. No, not you who thinks you're part of the covenant. No, not you who thinks you did enough stuff. No, not you who kept all those things. Great job, but you're still not good enough. All have turned aside in 12. Together they have become worthless. No one does good. No, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. We look at that verse and like, man, that's harsh. I have not done most of those things. Like, you look at that list and you're like, okay, like that's those people who have just done those things. Like, I don't see myself in there. But again, all the universal statements in the beginning, and then, okay, their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. How many of you have ever lied or ever twisted the truth at all? Don't need to raise your hand. We all have done it. Venom of asps is under their lips. How many times have you spoken with bitterness? How many times have you said words that cut somebody and you knew it and you wanted to do it? Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. How many times, rather than pointing somebody to something praiseworthy and pointing them to how God is still good in this circumstance, how many times have you just complained with them? How many times have you just looked at the negative of the situation? Now, that's not to say that life's not hard sometimes, but how many times do you just not push yourself to God? You just instead allow yourself to wallow at the bottom and to be bitter and to complain and to focus on how just God is so bad to you right now. Their feet are swift to shed blood. And that's where we're like, okay, I'm good. I didn't do that one. But then you go back to what Jesus says about anger. If you've been angry with somebody, you've murdered them in your heart. How many times have you been angry with somebody? So you might not have shed physical blood, but how many times in your mind are you shedding their blood? In their paths are ruin and misery. How many times have you been so tempted to just bring ruin and misery to somebody because of what they're doing to your life? Even just kind of the comical one that we all think of first. Okay, somebody goes speeding by you on the road and they're like almost causing car accidents. You're like, man, I hope they get in an accident, or man, I hope they get pulled over. Like, are you dwelling on something good right there? And I know that's a little more common one. So in their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they have not known. How many times are we so tempted to, rather than working and striving for peace and striving to bring unity between us and somebody that we don't necessarily like that much, or even in our family, how many times are we, if not the cause, at least helping to create division as we try to seek to use this to get our own way? How many times are we not trying to be the peacemaker that we're called to be? And then he just sums up at the end, there is no fear of God before their eyes. How many times are you tempted to sin and you know it's wrong? You know all of the scripture truth that would hold you back from it. But in the end, you still say, that's worth it. I want it. We know the pain it's going to bring. We know the guilt it's going to bring. In fact, we know that Satan, the very one who's tempting us to do it, is going to be the one on the other side condemning us for doing it and saying we're such a horrible person, even though he was just the one encouraging us to do it. We know all these things are going to happen. It's kind of like when I remind people about the fence and the training, and when they get to the high levels, how some dogs react to it. I'm like, okay, you're going to get to a level where the dog's going to be doing great, but there are still going to be distractions. And we have seen this, where dogs will sit on the inside, bark, rev themselves up, get all excited, and go, getting shocked. They know they're getting shocked. They know it's going to hurt, and they still go through. How many times are we just like that dog that thinks that distraction is worth it? We know it's going to happen. We know the truth. We know we're not supposed to do it. And to us, it's still worth it. How many sins do we have that are that rabbit for us, or that bird for us? So we see in this string of quotes that he has universally condemned every single person. He's condemned them and said that all are totally depraved in their speech, in their actions, in their thoughts. Every part of you is opposed to God. When you are trying to do this on your own, you can't. And what's also ironic about this string of quotations, if you go back and look at the context, not really any of these are talking about like the good Jews. It's always talking about like the wicked people, the fool, the obviously unrighteous in Israel. It's always the writer separating himself from these other guys, these bad people over here. You know, I'm not like them. And Paul is using those quotes from that type of context to talk about these entitled Jews who think that they're part of the covenant, who think that they have it made. And what he's doing with this string is saying, okay, I know you know these texts, and I know you know that these are not talking about the writer. These are talking about the wicked and the fool. Well, guess what? You're the wicked. You're the fool. You're the unrighteous. You need this salvation just as much as they do. So we see that by the end of 18, Paul has completely obliterated the arguments of the entitled. We saw at the end of one that he obliterated any chance the pagan had, and two, he condemned the moralist, and he condemned the religionist, and now he's condemned kind of the subset of the religionist, those who think that just being part of the covenant is good enough. So he has, by this point, condemned all. And he ends in the last two verses with a summary of his case. And first, in 19, he just summarizes that all are condemned. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. I love the wording he uses there. I mean, you think back at those string of verses that no, not one, no, no, no. And this part is like, every mouth is stopped. Like, I know those objections you're having, but there are none. There is no objection you can make to this. No one will be justified in the sight of God because they did the works of the law. We see that the law condemns those who are under the law. And what's interesting here is if you look at the wording, okay, the law says it speaks to those who are under the law so that every mouth may be stopped and that the whole world may be held accountable to God. Okay, it speaks to those who are under the law. Well, wait a minute. Which law are you talking about? So if you're talking about the Mosaic law, then how is the whole world condemned by the Mosaic law when most of them didn't even have it? So there are two possible ways of taking this. The first one would be that all are accountable to the law they have. We saw at the end of one that there's natural law that the pagan are accountable for. We saw at the beginning of two that there's the law of the conscience that the moralist is accountable to. And we saw at the end of chapter two, and now this chapter, we see that there is the law of scripture, which the religioned are accountable to. So it could be that those who are under the law means those who are under any sort of law, which is, oh, by the way, everybody, those are accountable to God. It could also be that those under the law is referring to the Mosaic law, and he knows that this is the hardest one to prove, that even the Jews who have the covenant and who have a relationship to God are still condemned, even though they have the law. And now that he's proved this, he can extend that judgment to the whole world. It's kind of like a greater to lesser argument. Like, okay, if I can even condemn these Jews who have the law and know what they're supposed to do, and they think they're good, if they're even condemned, then there's no hope for all these other people. So it could be one of the two. In the end, the important thing is that he has proved that the entire world stands equally condemned before God. And then in verse 20, we see him talk about the function of the law. We see that by the works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. So in here we see what the function of the law isn't and what the function of the law is. First, we see what it isn't. For by the works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight. Whether you are doing it to earn your salvation, legalism, or whether you are doing it to stay in salvation, which is known as covenantal nomism, or basically, I have the covenant, and as long as I'm doing good things, then I'm still part of the covenant. Or whether you're just doing it to be a good person, whatever you're doing in your own strength to keep the law, that's not good enough. Because you can't keep the law perfectly. Actions are not enough. And we saw this back at the end of chapter 2, that it's not being circumcised that's important. It's not knowing and trying to do the law that's important. It's the circumcision of the heart that matters. Actions can be done from wrong motives. Think of the Pharisees. How many actions do they do from wrong motives? And actions can never be done perfectly. There are a lot of laws to keep. Even the priests had to give sacrifices for themselves. Even the priests, those who were supposed to uphold and be examples of the law, they failed. So the works of the law will not justify somebody. You can't be a good enough person You can't work your way into heaven. Because through the law comes knowledge of sin. So the law doesn't make you righteous. The law doesn't justify you. Because if you look at that law, there isn't a single one of you that can look at that law and say, I've kept it perfectly. In fact, what that law just did is that showed you where you haven't kept it perfectly. And that showed you the sin that you have so prevalent in your heart. And that makes you aware of God's requirements that you have fallen short of. So that's what the law actually did. Okay, you think the law is this great thing that you're going to put before God and be like, well, I did pretty well, so I get in heaven, right? That very thing you're putting before God is what's condemning you. Because that is showing you how sinful you are and that you haven't kept it perfectly. So we see in summary here in this 19 through 20 that all, yes, even the Jews who have the law, all stand equally condemned before God. It's a great news, right? Next week, we're going to get into the answer to this problem. But it has been vitally important to Paul, and I think he rightly took as long as he did, to show that we desperately need God. Salvation, the gospel, isn't good news until we actually think that we need it. It's just this, oh, cool story. And, well, that's nice. That's good of God to do that to me, but I don't really need that. And Paul knows he needs to shatter all of those thinkings, all of those assumptions in our mind, and show us that, no, we desperately need this. So what about you? Do you at times have an entitlement mentality? Do you think that God is only faithful when he's good to you? Have you forgotten, like the Israelites, that God's faithfulness is shown both in his blessing and his correction and his punishment of you? Have you forgotten that sometimes his faithfulness is being there for you in times of trouble, whether or not he actually gets you out of that time of trouble? Have you forgotten that sometimes his faithfulness is allowing us to be a testimony of his truth during our suffering, of him being our refuge and our hope and our source of unexplainable joy and peace that others will see and turn to him? Maybe him being faithful is him being there for you and giving you strength to be a testimony of him. This question reminds me of a song by Sovereign Grace. I'm not going to sing it, don't worry. I have the class I just finished, my lecturer, he had a decent voice, but he had all these like family little made-up songs and things that he would just randomly sing during the lecture. Regan would listen with them to me, and she just left the room whenever that happened. She's like, I can't do it. But I am going to read the lyrics because I love this song and the words. So as you listen to these lyrics, think of, okay, what does God's faithfulness mean to you? The song says, shall I take from your hand your blessing and not welcome any pain? Shall I thank you for days of sunshine, yet grumble in days of rain? Shall I love you in times of plenty, then leave you in days of drought? Shall I trust you when I reap the harvest, but when winter winds blow, then doubt? Oh, let your will be done in me. In your love I will abide. Oh, I long for nothing else as long as you are glorified. Are you good only when I prosper and true only when I'm filled? Are you king only when I'm carefree and God only when I'm well? You are good when I'm poor and needy. You are true when I'm parched and dry. You still reign in the deepest valley. You're still God in the darkest night. So quiet my restless heart. Quiet my restless heart in you. When God's faithfulness doesn't look like what you want it to, are you still willing to say, your will be done? Are you still willing to say, I will abide in you and trust in you, and that I long for nothing else but your glory. So what is your view of God's faithfulness? And in what are you trusting for salvation? Some common trusts are in doing more right than wrong and in being a good person and keeping the law, or in being included in a covenant, which might not seem like it applies to us, but how many people out there know that they've said a prayer or walked an aisle, or that they've said they're a Christian and they're part of a Christian family and they've gone to Christian school and they went to university? How many people just feel that being part or being associated with Christians or having at one time said a prayer or something like that just has them set for life? How many people are not trusting in a covenant necessarily, but trusting in a profession or in a head knowledge? Paul has taken these first three chapters to shatter all of these arguments. If you are trusting in any of these things, then you have no hope. And if those around you, your family, your friends, your neighbors, co-workers, if those you know are trusting in any of these things, then they have no hope. That's what Paul's been building up to this point. If you are trusting in anything other than genuine faith, you have no hope. God revealed himself to us through nature, through our conscience, and through his word. Not so that we could feel that, oh, we're entitled to this, or I know this thing, or I've done pretty well for this, or I'm better than that person. He revealed himself through those things so that we could see that we need him. And we need him desperately. In the next section, we are going to see how God has worked to make a way for us to be set free from this bondage of sin that we are all under and this condemnation that we all face. Paul thought it was so important to first help us see where we are that he spent almost three chapters on it. So if you aren't saved, have you come to a place where you've recognized your need? Are you still holding on to one or more of these arguments? Do you think that you can be good enough? Do you think that because you have Christian background, that that's good enough? If that's where you are, then you need to grasp the truth of these chapters and know that there is nothing you can do. But there is also good news, that you can't do anything, but that God has done everything for you. That he has made a way for salvation by sending his son to die and to take your place as punishment and to be your ransom so that you could be set free from this bondage of sin. You cannot please God on your own, but he himself made a way so that there is no pride, so that there is no, well, of course I'm saved. God puts everybody in the same need so that everybody needs him just as much. And in this way, he can offer his salvation to all because all need it. If you are saved, do you remind yourself of who you are without God? Just think of when you're tempted, those times that you allow yourself to fall. Think of how easy that is, how natural that is. That's you without God. Now think of where that road would take you as you go throughout life if you kept giving into that, if there was no help from God inside of you. It's scary to think where we would end up if God wasn't helping us. Or think of the times that you've tried to fight sin in your own strength. The whole, I can do this and I can be strong because I'm a Christian and I can overcome this sin. So you get your plan, you get your five-step plan or whatever it is for you, and you try to just will this conquering of sin to happen? Have you forgotten that you can't conquer this sin without God's strength? That's not to say you shouldn't try and you shouldn't do your part, but your part will amount to nothing without the strength of God behind it. So rather than trying to beat your head against a brick wall as you try to beat this sin, why don't you ask the God who can shatter that wall to help you beat that sin? And rely on the community of the church that he's given to keep you accountable and to help you overcome and to point you to Christ as you fight against that sin. Do you cry out to him for help each day, or do you try to handle life on your own? And do you remember that others are as in desperate need of salvation and help as you were and are? God's salvation is for all, and he didn't save you just for you. He didn't save you and then bring you up to heaven right away. He has a purpose for you while you're here after you've been saved, and that's to help point others to Christ and to be a Christ-like example. So are you seeking to do that? We like to focus on the good news. We like to focus on the pleasant things and the faithfulness of God in that, and he's good to us and he blesses us. Sometimes we like to be like the entitled Jews, and we like to focus on all the good things and the good promises. And I think at times we need to, just as Paul has finished doing now, we need to remember where we are and who we are without God. And that we need him, and that he is faithful to us both when he blesses us and when he corrects us to bring us back into faithfulness to him. We need him just as much in both times. And sometimes our suffering, sometimes our correction is what we need to bring us into a better relationship with God. Think of how many times in your life that you have grown dramatically and how you've just seen God active and become into a closer relationship with him through suffering, through difficulties, through whatever it might be. And think of how many times that happened when life was going well. Not nearly as many. I'm not to say that God just automatically doom and gloom and everything in your life is bad, because he knows what that builds you. He does bless us. But I think we are wasting every opportunity to grow when we always are trying to get out of suffering and get out of difficulty. That's not to say that we shouldn't do what we can, and that if it's suffering we brought on ourselves through laziness, we'll stop being lazy or things like that. But if it's genuine struggle, like a sickness or car accident or whatever, are you wasting your suffering and not becoming more like Christ through it?